Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. Sir Peter Horby, Moe Family Foundation Professor of Emerging Infections and Global Health and Director of Oxford's Pandemic Sciences Institute, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, Andy, and thank you for inviting me.
So, Peter, you're here because you were very involved in evaluating different treatments during the pandemic. And we're going to come and talk about those in a moment in some leading research that you were involved in, which had a huge impact around the world on patients with COVID-19. But I want to take you back to where this all started. And you did your medical training at UCL in London.
Well, my very first house job when I qualified was actually on the AIDS wards at UCL. That was pre-antiretrovirals, and there were some incredibly sick, mostly young men. And that really, for me, was the starting point, straight away seeing the dreadful illnesses and tragedy that can come from infectious diseases.
So when was that, Peter? So, I mean, HIV was really recognised in the early 80s. So when was it that you were working on the wards?
That was in the early 90s. So at that time, there were some early trials of antiretrovirals, but they were not available. And we had a ward full of mostly gay and bisexual men who were dreadfully ill and literally dropping like flies. It was dreadful. But, and the change we've seen since then just shows you that there's huge advances that can be made in infectious diseases. I also was particularly interested because infectious diseases, not only are they interesting clinically, but they're interesting socially and politically as well. You know, my risk of having heart disease doesn't affect your risk. Well, they have many, many dimensions. So I became very interested. So then I went on through my clinical training and I came back to London and worked at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases, which was also, fascinating because I had to do my own malaria slides at night and all sorts of old-fashioned things. But it was great. You could actually see the patient, make a tentative diagnosis, take the blood, do the slides yourself and treat the patient.
So the slides are to look for the malaria parasites in the blood. And so you were there doing the hours of looking after adults with infections that they'd acquired from travel at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases. Where did that then sort of drive you to move forwards into your academic career?
So I then had to make a choice whether to specialise in clinical infectious diseases or public health. And it was a bit of a difficult decision to make. But in the end, I decided to do public health training with what then was the Public Health Laboratory Service, because, infection in the UK was mostly not that interesting, to be honest. Hospital for Tropical Diseases was a rare place with very interesting infections. And there were a lot of, senior doctors waiting for senior posts and not many interesting posts to go to. And I've always been interested in public health as well. So I shifted tack later in my training and trained at Public Health Laboratory Service in Colindale in infectious diseases and public health. And then during that entire time, I was chomping at the bit to go and work in the tropics.
So how did you make that step then to get to the tropics?
I actually qualified as a consultant. And my very first job was head of the variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease group at Colindale, which is the mad cow disease. But, it was a very interesting disease, but again, very rare. And so when there were ever outbreaks, I always, pushed hard to try and get myself a secondment overseas. And I finally managed that during the SARS-1 outbreak in 2003, where I was permitted to volunteer for WHO. And I was sent as part of the outbreak response team to Vietnam for SARS-1.
And so then SARS-1, obviously, that was the coronavirus first emerging around 2002 and causing thousands of infections. But because it didn't transmit very well and it was possible to isolate, public health actually was all that was needed to control that outbreak. So what were you actually doing in that? Were you there dealing directly with the patients or in the laboratory side?
So I was dealing with the outbreak control and response. So what we were doing was we were basically doing contact tracing. So we were going and seeing patients and doing contact tracing, healthcare workers, family members, looking at travel history and going out into the villages and countryside, tracing contacts and quarantining them.
So did you actually find many other cases, given the low transmissibility or relatively low transmissibility?
We found a couple, not many. There was some transmission, but it was also mostly very close contacts. We did find some transmission, but most of the transmission, thankfully for us, was in late stage disease. So most of the patients who were highly transmissible were already quite sick and were in hospital. So that's an environment where it's easier to control transmission than in the community.
And of course, the really scary thing about SARS-1 was the very high mortality rate. And I suppose when you think about how much these viruses mutate, that if that had been allowed to persist in human populations without public health controls, it's very possible that it could have adapted and started spreading better, because, of course, that's good for the virus if it can spread better.
That's right. I think we really dodged a bullet with SARS-1. It was pretty close. And as we saw with SARS-2, COVID-19, it did improve its transmissibility over time. And so we managed to control SARS-1 before it managed to do that, but it was a close shave.
And it's an interesting comparison also when you look at that mortality that you've described. I've seen figures from about 10 or 11%. If we were dealing with a pandemic with that sort of mortality, it would have been a completely different way that we would have responded as a society to 1 in 10 people dying. I mean, it's just astonishing difference it would make, whereas we're much less than 1% with COVID-19.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that's perhaps hard to tell to people, that, you know, COVID could have been a lot worse. There are more virulent viruses out there with higher case fatality rates, and some viruses that, you know, are particularly severe in children, which thankfully we didn't see with COVID.
Many families are obviously affected by COVID-19, and it's been very traumatic for many people. But as you say, it could have been so much worse than it was if it had been a pandemic with a mortality on that sort of scale.
Yeah.
So how did you then go from, you know, being a jobbing public health doctor in Vietnam, responding to a fascinating outbreak, to actually moving forwards into an academic leadership position, I think in Vietnam initially?
Yeah, so I initially went to Vietnam for about 6 weeks, but they asked me to stay on to take over the role of being the head of communicable disease surveillance and response in the World Health Organization office in Vietnam, because tragically, the person who was doing that position, Carlo Urbani, he was also doing parasitology, died from SARS. He was the first person to sort of raise the alarm when he saw an outbreak in the hospital in Vietnam. And so they asked me to take on that role, which I took on. And actually, you know, a few months into that position, we started to see cases of very severe respiratory illness in children with high case fatality rate, which turned out to be the emergence of avian influenza, the subtype H5N1. And so we walked straight into another nasty infection with high fatality.
Of course, that H5N1 we're seeing again today, but transmitting largely in birds, both wild and domestic. But the term coined bird flu really comes from that initial outbreak.
It does, that's right. I remember I was doing some teaching, it was actually Christmas Eve, and I was called by the director of the paediatric hospital to say he had, I think it was 5 children who were very severely ill, and he thought they had SARS. So we got straight back in the car and went down to the paediatric hospital, and the clinical picture was different from SARS. You know, we hadn't really seen children being affected. There wasn't nosocomial transmission. All of the children were from rural families. And when we asked around, there had been stories of bird deaths. So we actually took the blood samples and sent them to Hong Kong to Malik Peres's lab to look for avian influenza, and it came back positive. And then all hell broke loose, really.
Yes, there was then a big global response saying we actually should start stockpiling vaccines against H5N1. And here in Oxford, I was involved in trials of various H5N1 vaccines to try and make sure that the world was better prepared if it did then, as had happened with this small group of children, then start spreading more rapidly between people. But again, that virus didn't seem to do that.
No, but it's a salutary lesson that, you know, it was, almost 20 years between SARS-1 and SARS-2. And we had this sort of boom and bust where everyone was very excited about SARS-1. And a lot of the funders got bored very quickly and thought, well, it's gone away, we're safe. And then, you know, nearly 2 decades later, a version of it reappears and causes a pandemic. And so, you know, having seen quite a lot of patients with, you know, severe avian influenza, it's a very nasty infection, or can be a very nasty infection. We really mustn't sort of make the same mistake again, thinking that because it's been a long time, it's not going to happen.
Of course, now we have a pandemic in wildlife of H5N1 that's ongoing at this very moment.
We do. And I think it's the biggest threat is a zoonotic influenza virus. And we saw that the 2009 influenza pandemic was not severe, probably came from swine or, you know, a mixture of sources. That can easily happen and is almost certain to happen again at some point. We just have to be ready for it, because it could be a more severe strain of flu that could cause a very nasty pandemic.
So you went to Vietnam for 6 weeks, and now the years are starting to go past, I think, and you've still not got a ticket home. So what were you doing there over the 2000s?
Well, I got a phone call from Jeremy Farrar, who was head of a research unit in Ho Chi Minh City in the south of Vietnam. Initially, it was about writing a paper on a clinical description of the early H5N1 cases. And, it's funny now, but I actually asked him to send me his CV because I hadn't heard of him. He became director of the Wellcome Trust, and he's now the chief scientist of WHO. And when I saw the CV, I thought, oh, well, OK, maybe I should take this guy seriously. So we worked together on the first clinical description of the H5N1 cases. And then later on, he offered me a position to open a sister clinical research unit in Hanoi, in the Hospital for Tropical Diseases, which is the hospital I was talking about that, the SARS cases were in and the bird flu cases were in. And I remember talking to the WHO country office director at the time, and he said, oh, don't be so stupid. These academic careers are never successful, and you'll never go anywhere, and you'll be back knocking at my door in 6 months. So I'm very pleased to prove him wrong. So I left WHO. I took a chance on Jeremy and opened a research unit within the Hospital for Tropical Diseases on the top floor. And to begin with, it was me and a few pencils, but it soon grew.
And what was the focus over your time there working in Vietnam? I mean, were you still looking for respiratory infections, outbreaks of those, or were you looking more broadly across different disease areas?
So the research unit, we expanded to do a broader range of things. My particular research as the director was around respiratory viral infections, seasonal influenza, pandemic influenza, and avian influenza. And that's actually when I did my PhD. I was in Vietnam and directing the research unit. Did a PhD at the same time because we were doing that research. But we also hired people to work on antimicrobial resistance, which was a big problem, and on dengue as well, and on central nervous system infections. So we had a broader range of diseases we were looking at.
But with that sort of tracking the diseases work that you were doing, how did that then get you into an interest in drugs, both, conventional drugs as well as new drugs for treating these viruses?
Well, after SARS-1, I was asked to give a lot of talks, as happens. And I remember writing and giving a talk about all the opportunities we missed in SARS-1. We didn't really do the sort of work we should have done. We didn't really look closely enough at the viral kinetics, the sources, which tissues are infected, how all of them are infected for, the immune responses, the responses to therapy. Profiling of metabolic pathways in patients. There was an awful lot of stuff we could have done, and we didn't. We did a case control study and some track and trace, basically, and that was just about it. And so there were a lot of missed opportunities, and so that's what really, got me thinking about how do we do research in epidemics. And when I started the research unit in Vietnam, that really sort of became a focus. Then is there's little research done on this particular class of infectious diseases, outbreak infectious diseases, and trying to understand why that was. A lot of it is down to the difficult context and epidemiology. They're unpredictable. The outbreaks are very quick. They're often very small. There's often a lot of chaos. There's a lot of political desire to see things shut down, in terms of shut down the outbreak, keep quiet, and let's just get it over and done with. And so trying to do research was always a hard ask. So, really since then, I've been trying to sort of find ways that we can do better clinical research under those particular circumstances.
And I suppose a particular problem is also that you don't know where the outbreak's going to happen. So you've got to be able to parachute into where it happens. And then the complexities of getting the ethical approval to go and do the research, to get regulatory approval if it's a drug that you're going to test, is really quite a big ask to do in the middle of an outbreak, when I guess often the clinicians in the front line really don't want anyone getting in the way of them trying to save the life of the patient.
Yeah, and I think, you used the P word, Andy, the parachute word. It's clear that is the wrong approach. We had some dreadful behaviour when I was. So I led the avian flu response for the WHO office in Vietnam, And we had more than 80 consultants come through from various international organizations, including academic institutions and public health agencies. And there was some terrible behavior going on. And it was clear that the local clinicians were cheesed off by that, rightly so. They often had a desire to improve care, but, you know, not much understanding of how to do research and almost no support to do research. So that's been part of the dynamic, really, is how we can build partnerships so that we can work as a sort of a community of researchers to support each other to do the research, but as far as possible, locally led.
And be ready to respond rather than having to use a parachute. Actually be there ready to respond because they're already working in surveillance of some sort, for example.
Yeah, already doing, you know, clinical studies so that they have the tools ready.
So where does Iseric come from then? And what does Iseric mean? Or Iseric, depending on how you like to pronounce it.
Yeah, I'm agnostic on how it's pronounced, but I'm not agnostic that it's a terrible acronym. The International Severe Acute Respiratory and Emerging Infections Consortium. But it got some
very catchy.
It got some brand sort of value, so we kept it. We did think about changing it about 5 years ago, but we didn't. So again, Jeremy Farrow was the catalyst for that. So, you know, he'd been through SARS-1 as well, and he'd been through avian influenza as well in the same country at the same time as me. And then we were both there when the 2009 influenza pandemic started. And again, there was a failure to do good, particularly clinical research. There was better public health research about transmission, and there was pretty good virology, but really no good clinical studies done. And that really was inexcusable, because SARS, you can understand, and bird flu, you can understand, dangerous and not many cases. But flu, we have flu every year. Everywhere has flu every year. And there's a lot of cases, and there were a lot of cases during the pandemic of 2009. And we've known we'll get a flu pandemic at some point. So what was the excuse this time? There wasn't really one. So that's when Iseric was set up as a consortium of clinical research networks. So a group, really a network of networks. So a global network of clinical research networks who were interested in being able to respond to emerging infectious diseases. And so that's been running since, I think, about 2011 is when it sort of was officially first funded, and is still running now. And I've been the first of all the director, and now the executive director of that for quite a few years now.
And what does that consortium do? I mean, it's obviously there waiting for diseases to come. Is it testing drugs or doing surveillance? What it's actually doing?
So it's very much focused on clinical studies. So it started off like that, and we had a big strategic review some years back, where we decided that really was the sweet spot where we wanted to be. There's a lot of people doing public health research, and there's public health surveillance bodies, and it's their remit to do that kind of surveillance. But clinical research really wasn't of the quality or extent needed. And so we've kept focused on that. And so we do several main things, one of them, which is clinical epidemiology. So better clinical characterization of infectious diseases, particularly emerging infectious diseases. And we have a protocol we developed with the World Health Organization called the Clinical Characterization Protocol. And so we've been running that, and we activated that very early for COVID-19 and have assembled a very big data set of more than 1 million case patients from 74 countries around the world. And also in some countries, they've done very effective biological sampling that's been very informative. So that's the sort of clinical descriptive side. We're applying that to other diseases, not just to respiratory diseases. We also have a protocol for hemorrhagic fevers like Ebola, and we're developing one at the moment for another class of viruses called hinipaviruses, which come from bats in Southeast Asia. And then the second part is clinical trials. So we've been doing clinical trials. So we currently have a clinical trial running in plague in Madagascar. We set up clinical trials in COVID-19, And we're working and we've run clinical trials in Ebola as well.
So fantastic work that's been going on, that characterising all of these diseases in quite some detail, particularly in the biological sampling sense of really understanding a lot of what's going on in the response from the infected individuals, as well as what's going on with the pathogen. So at some point, you then did finally get a ticket to come back to the UK. Why did you come back? What have you been doing when you arrived back?
So we came back because I'd been in Vietnam 9 years. And a time had come to decide whether we're staying there for the duration or whether we were going to move on. So we actually transitioned back gently through Singapore. So we were in Singapore for 3 years, where I continued doing research in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, China and other places with colleagues, but did not any longer run the unit in Hanoi, and also did some work on infectious disease research sort of coordination in Singapore, and then finally transitioned back to the UK in 2014, really for family reasons. It's not really the place to be doing tropical and outbreak infectious diseases, or so we thought until COVID started.
Yeah, I guess running that network of clinical characterization, and you probably would have known even by December of 2019 that there was something happening in China, but certainly by early 2020. So at what point were you aware that there was a pandemic of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus?
Well, I knew there was a problem in very, very early January, so January 1, 2. And we have an ISARIC member network in China. And so we were having, you know, I had a call with the person leading that network on January 2nd. And it turns out that he had been nominated by the Chinese Ministry of Health to go to Wuhan to run the clinical research response, because he was a very well-respected respiratory physician, ICU physician, who was running pneumonia trials in China. So he traveled to Wuhan, and we had regular calls where he appraised me of the situation clinically, and it was, you know, very concerning. What was happening. And we supported him through ISARIC to set up the first clinical trials in SARS-CoV-2. And I think it was a great example of where that the ISARIC sort of peer-to-peer network worked really well, because one of our other ISARIC members who runs a network in Saudi Arabia is the sort of clinical lead for MERS coronavirus, which is another coronavirus that comes from camels. And the country with the most cases is Saudi Arabia.
And caused the largest outbreak in humans about just over 10 years ago.
Yes, yeah. But not where you'd expect it. It was in South Korea, wasn't it? But so we actually, you know, very early on in January had a call between myself, a colleague in Saudi Arabia, and the colleague who was at that time in Wuhan, describing the protocols that had been tried for MERS-CoV and see if they could be applied to the outbreak in Wuhan, because by that time it was become apparent it was a coronavirus. And so the very first trial that was started, a randomized controlled trial, was using actually an anti-HIV drug that had been used in patients with MERS-CoV-2. So that was really nice to bring together clinicians who had experience of different severe coronaviruses to sort of talk through the design of a trial and what might be appropriate.
So when was that actually happening? How early in 2020 was that?
In January, the first patient was enrolled in the randomized controlled trial in January.
That's amazingly quick.
Then another trial was opened, which was actually a placebo-controlled trial, was the second trial opened, and that was also opened in Wuhan. You know, so I think that was sometime in February, I'll have to check, but very early on.
And that was still looking at anti-HIV drugs or a different type of...
The second trial was remdesivir.
Okay.
Yeah, which is now licensed for COVID.
And so those interactions, you'd then got a very good picture then of what was happening in Wuhan at that time. So were the clinicians seeing vast numbers of patients like we saw here in the UK once in sort of February, March, that the numbers started to tick up?
It was hard to get a picture of the numbers because, you know, some of the hospitals were very busy, but it was the diagnostics weren't there. So it was unclear to what extent, you know, these were this new viral disease or they were people who had other infections and were worried that they had the new infection or had been sent to the hospital because the authorities were worried they had the new infection. And there were also a lot of, you know, worried well flooding the hospitals as well. So getting a sense of the numbers was difficult. But I think, well, talking to the clinicians there, it was clear that it was a worrying clinical scenario. And there are one thing that's always a red flag is when you see healthcare workers getting infected. And the early reports from him that he was seeing healthcare workers who were severely ill and requiring ventilation, for me, that was the real red flag that this is something we have to be very serious about.
So you led with Sir Martin Landrieu the recovery trial. Is that sort of like an offshoot of what you'd been doing over the previous decade, or was that something completely new, a new concept?
It was. It took forward quite a lot of the learning. You know, we'd learned a lot about how to do research in epidemic sort of settings. One is that you do have to be very quick because you can very easily miss the peak. And so to do that, you've got to have a very simple trial and sort of get started as quickly as possible with a sort of a minimum product and then enroll as many patients as you can. So again, make it as simple as possible because there is a lot of chaos and panic and a lot of people in healthcare system and healthcare workers are incredibly busy. So asking them to do anything extra is very hard. So actually, based on the fact that we've started these trials in Wuhan, we applied for grant money to expand it into a platform trial. By the time the funding committee had met, the outbreak had been controlled in Wuhan, and we didn't enroll enough patients to have any conclusive result in Wuhan in those two trials, but we were starting to see transmission in Europe. And so I was phoned up by the funders saying, you know, we'll fund this, but you've got to move it from China, because it was originally to be done in China. You've got to move it from China to the UK. So we said, oh, okay. Yeah, that, we think that's the right decision, and we did that. But then you've got a, you know, basically a sort of tropical doctor who's only really done sort of clinical studies in low-income settings, trying to think how to do this in the NHS. And so I thought, well, I've got to talk to someone who I, you know, who knows how to do this stuff in the UK, which is certainly not me. So myself and Martin sort of teamed up, and that was partly because I was looking for someone because we had this grant and we had some ideas about what we wanted to do. And Martin had talked to Jeremy Farrar on the whatever number bus who'd said, talk to Peter. So we sort of both at the same time talked to each other and said, you know, we need to talk to each other. And it's another sort of irony that I actually remember giving a talk in China to the chap who was subsequently in Wuhan, trying to convince him that we should be aiming in China to be doing infectious diseases trial on the scale of the cardiovascular disease trials that were done out of Oxford, like the aspirin studies and the clotbuster studies, and the showing slides saying, look, this is the scope of cardiovascular trials, tens of thousands of people. You could do this in China for infections, but we're doing hundreds of patients. And so really it was something that I'd wanted to do, was to, you know, actually sort of get my hands on a really large scale infectious disease trial. So in a sense, the stars were aligned because we had Martin, who, you know, is brilliant and was fantastic at thinking through how we make this as simple as possible. But obviously is a cardiologist, non-infectious disease person. And you had me, who sort of understood the infections and the problem, but didn't really know how to do a big trial in the UK.
So the concept behind doing the recovery trial was actually to look at multiple different possible therapies. How is that different from what was happening elsewhere in the world? Because there were lots of studies of drugs, in particularly in the US, but also in other countries. So what were you doing differently from these other studies? Because I think many people will be aware, the recovery trial has given us huge amounts of information about what works and what doesn't.
Yes, so when we were designing it, it looked apparent that we were not going to have a lack of cases, that this was not going to be controllable, and there would be a lot of sick people, and there would be a lot of patients, and probably there would be a lot of demand for evidence about which drugs work. So we thought we should start out, you know, from the outset on an ambitious tack, and there weren't any super promising drugs at that time. There wasn't a clear winner that you would back, or a clear horse you would back. So we designed it so that we would look at multiple interventions, thinking that we could, you know, we could probably get enough patients to do that. And we sort of committed a heresy, a sort of clinical trial heresy, in that we didn't have a sample size calculation, as in we had not specified the exact number of patients we were going to enroll up front. We had put in the first protocol up to 20,000, and we thought that was ridiculously sort of ambitious. We ended up doing more than double that. And as we designed it, and it was designed to be extremely simple so that it could be, you know, most patients could be enrolled and it wouldn't take the clinicians very long and the nurses very long to enroll patients. And we started to see the numbers really, really rack up very, very quickly, where we had, you know, 1,000 patients within a week, and, you know, the patients were flooding in. We realized that, you know, we could be more ambitious. So we started to add more drugs, and we've managed to, you know, answer questions on nearly all of them. So I think we have now results on 11 different potential therapeutics.
And so these are existing drugs that may or may not have been useful in treating patients with COVID, which we wouldn't have known without those trials comparing a control group, the group who received the drug.
Yes, that's right. We started off with what we call repurposed drugs, which is drugs that are already licensed for another indication, like aspirin or like steroids. They're very well-known drugs, and people are familiar with using them. So we started with those because it's a sort of an easy win, in a sense that the drugs are in the pharmacy cabinet in the hospitals. All the doctors know how to use them. They know the risk profile is very well known. And the regulators, as in the organizations that license drugs, were comfortable with these drugs. So we started with those. But later on, we did add novel drugs. So new drugs that were developed for COVID, we added those in later. But we started with the sort of the repurposed drugs. And part of that was because that's what was available and we wanted to get out of the blocks straight away. And once we had the system bedded down, we could start to be looking at more sort of experimental drugs.
But those repurposed drugs, you are selecting things that there is some rationale to think they might be useful.
Yes, that's right. You know, we did go through a process of looking at what was available and saying, yeah, that's ridiculous. That's possible, but unlikely. And this one, well, there is a reasonable likelihood that there may be a benefit. And they were particularly attractive because if they did prove to work, then they would be very widely available and very affordable, which is what we wanted. We didn't want to test things that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars that only a handful of people would ever get.
Perhaps the most dramatic of the effects of all of these that fits in exactly with what you've just described was the use of a steroid called dexamethasone, which fits that bill. It's easily available everywhere in the world and it's cheap. So what did you find with treating patients with that drug?
It's interesting because that was one of the first drugs we put in, and there was a, you know, there was a big camp saying, you know, it's counterintuitive to give an immunosuppressive drug that suppresses your immune system, to someone whose immune system is currently fighting an infection. You're going to make it worse. And there had been some unconvincing data from the past that giving steroids to people with infections can make things worse. But at the same time, there was other evidence that patients with some infections do improve with steroids. And there was emerging data that patients with severe COVID had, you know, high inflammatory state. And so I think that's the perfect sort of scenario in which to do a trial, when there's a cheap available drug, you know the safety profile of it, and there's two opposed camps about whether it works or not. So that's perfect. So, well, let's solve this. Let's do a trial of it. So, you know, we did get quite a lot of grief for putting it in from some people, but most people accepted that this was a reasonable thing to try and evaluate.
How well did it protect?
Surprisingly well. You know, the first result we had was hydroxychloroquine in hospitalized patients is ineffective, which still to this day has, you know, annoyed some people. We think we did it because we were trying to get rid of a cheap drug so the pharma companies could make a lot of money.
Yeah, so hydroxychloroquine is a malaria treatment that is easily available, as you say, old and cheap.
Yes, but the people that criticise us for that, or claim that we deliberately showed it didn't work, sort of fail to forget that the next result was dexamethasone, which is an equally cheap drug that's off licence and is generic and costs a few quid, was very effective. So the pharma conspiracy doesn't really stack up. The second result in June was that in patients who had more severe lung disease, so patients who required oxygen or more than that, going up to requiring an artificial ventilator, it reduced their likelihood of dying. And in patients who were on a ventilator, it reduced it a lot by about sort of 20, 25, 30%.
So that is an enormous impact when we think of on our television screens here in the UK in early 2020 with intensive care units full of patients, many of whom would have died. The arrival of dexamethasone then reduced the chance of dying by as much as 30%, which when you look at that on a global scale is a huge number of lives saved. Has anyone done an analysis of what sort of impact it's had?
A very early analysis was done. It was, which estimated, at that point, I can't remember when it was, it's probably early 2021, I think, was that, up to 1 million lives had been already saved by the use of dexamethasone. So really, I think that's got to be the pinnacle of a career, is feeling that you've done that. You know, it was really great to have a positive result, but it was probably the best result we could have got. It was one of the cheapest and most available and very safe drugs. So it was absolutely brilliant result.
And it shows the importance of actually doing these trials simply but rigorously, because, of course, there were lots of other trials which were undertaken, as I alluded to before, in other countries where things were not done on enough patients or with a proper control group, so that you were left still unsure whether they really worked. And it's hard to implement something with uncertainty, whereas this was such a clear result.
Yes, unfortunately, there's a lot to be done in improving how clinical trials are conducted. There's huge waste, really. The US Food and Drug Administration, which is the sort of drug regulatory body in the US, did a review of COVID therapeutic clinical trials. And by their reckoning, 95% of them were designed to not give you a usable answer because they weren't properly designed, basically. And that's a lot. So that was, almost 2,000 trials that were designed to fail, basically. And that's a huge waste of human resource in the staff that did it, a huge waste of goodwill amongst patients enrolling them in trials that were not really likely to give a good result or a reliable result, and a huge waste of money. So there's a lot to be done.
The funders must have put huge amounts into 2,000 trials in order to run those if they were never going to give usable results. So I think it really shows how important recovery has been in both establishing which drugs don't work as well as those that do. So in June of 2020, when those results came out, you found yourself in number 10 Downing Street announcing the results to the world. How did that moment feel?
Kind of surreal, really. I went to the gates of, Downing Street, and they just checked my name on a list and, let me in. And I said, well, what do I do now? They said, just go and knock on the door. Okay, so wander up, knock on the door, and they say, come in, and then next minute you're sort of sat with Boris, the Prime Minister, who's asking you, are you sure this is right? Because obviously they don't want to make a faux pas on national television. And then a few minutes later you're up in the briefing room, not the briefing room, you're up in the room in front of the cameras, on live in front of the country, so to speak. So, but I actually didn't feel nervous because, we had a great story to tell and wanted to tell it. So it was easy.
Yeah. And as we've discussed, a huge impact on the world. And I think quite rightly, you and Martin have both been recognised that through being knighted by the Queen in 2021, which is thoroughly deserved. And, you also continue to work on these studies looking in other viral infections as well as COVID, work on drugs which might improve outcomes, and also advise the government on emerging viruses, which I think is a really important role in thinking about how we prepare ourselves for future outbreaks, including, as we were talking about, bird flu, if that were to jump species and cause problems in humans. So with all that going on, how do you find time to relax, and what do you do?
Yeah, it has been a very intense couple of years, what with, advising government in various forms and doing the recovery trial, which I guess, in a sense, the recovery trial was almost a light relief because it was enjoyable to see it, go so well. But, I run a bit, and I took up windsurfing in the summer of 2020, which I still do. I was down at Weymouth last weekend. I'm still not awfully good, but I do enjoy it.
Ah, very good. I was thinking it might be quite difficult to do that living in central Oxford, about as far away as you can get from the sea. But I guess there's a few reservoirs and lakes around that you can go to.
Yeah, there's a very nice reservoir with actually a very big windsurfing club, one of the biggest in the country, funnily enough, in the centre of the country. Seems odd, but
Very good. And so, I mean, back as a medical student at UCL, I can't imagine you didn't even think that this is where you would be a few decades later. What do you think you might have ended up doing if you hadn't found yourself in the midst of tropical medicine?
As a medical student, there were two things I enjoyed. One was infectious diseases, and the other was actually accident and emergency. So I did that for a few years. I quite liked sort of fixing people. So I quite like acute diseases where you can sort of fix people rather than chronic diseases. So it was one or the other. But I think infections got more interesting dynamics than sort of A&E and trauma.
Sir Peter Horby, thank you so much for spending time with us on this podcast. And we look forward to seeing you windsurfing into the sunset.
Thank you very much, Andy. Pleasure.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.